Principle 4.3. Understand the great brain battles and how to control them to get what you want. In the rest of this chapter, we will explore the different ways your brain fights for control of you. While I will refer to the specific parts of the brain that neurophysiologists believe are responsible for the specific types of thinking and emotions, the actual physiology is much more complex, and scientists are only beginning to understand it. A. Realize that the conscious mind is in a battle with the subconscious mind. Earlier in the audiobook, I introduced the concept of the two yous and explained how your higher level you can look down on your lower level you to make sure that your lower level you isn't sabotaging what your higher level you wants. Though I've often seen these two yous in action in myself and others, it wasn't until I learned why they exist that I really understood them. As with animals, many of our decision-making drivers are below the surface. An animal doesn't decide to fly or hunt or sleep or fight in the way that we go about making many of our own choices of what to do. It simply follows the instructions that come from the subconscious parts of its brain. These same sorts of instructions come to us from the same parts of our brain, sometimes for good evolutionary reasons and sometimes to our detriment. Our subconscious fears and desires drive our motivations and actions through emotions such as love, fear, and inspiration. It's physiological. Love, for example, is a cocktail of chemicals such as oxytocin, secreted by the pituitary gland. While I had always assumed that logical conversation is the best way for people to get at what is true, armed with this new knowledge about the brain, I came to understand that there are large parts of our brains that don't do what is logical. For example, I learned that when people refer to their feelings, such as saying, "I feel that you were unfair with me," they are typically referring to messages that originate in the emotional subconscious parts of their brains. I also came to understand that while some subconscious parts of our brains are dangerously animalistic, others are smarter and quicker than our conscious minds. Our greatest moments of inspiration often pop up from our subconscious. We experience these creative breakthroughs when we are relaxed and not trying to access the part of the brain in which they reside, which is generally the neocortex. When you say, "I just thought of something," you noticed your subconscious mind telling your conscious mind something. With training, it's possible to open this stream of communication. Many people only see the conscious mind and aren't aware of the benefits of connecting it to the subconscious. They believe that the way to accomplish more is to cram more into the conscious mind and make it work harder, but this is often counterproductive. While it may seem counterintuitive, clearing your head can be the best way to make progress. Knowing this, I now understand why creativity comes to me when I relax, like when I'm in the shower, and how meditation helps open this connection. Because it is physiological, I can actually feel the creative thoughts coming from elsewhere and flowing into my conscious mind. It's a kick to understand how that works. But a note of caution is in order too. When thoughts and instructions come to me from my subconscious rather than acting on them immediately, I have gotten into the habit of examining them with my conscious, logical mind. I have found that in addition to helping me figure out which thoughts are valid and why I am reacting to them as I do, doing this opens further communication between my conscious and subconscious minds. It's helpful to write down the results of this process. In fact, that's how my principles came about. If you take nothing else away from this chapter, be aware of your subconscious, of how it can both harm you and help you, and how by consciously reflecting on what comes out of it, perhaps with the help of others, you can become happier and more effective. B. Know that the most constant struggle is between feeling and thinking. There are no greater battles than those between our feelings, most importantly controlled by our amygdala, which operates subconsciously, and our rational thinking, most importantly controlled by our prefrontal cortex, which operates consciously. If you understand how those battles occur, you will understand why it is so important to reconcile what you get from your subconscious with what you get from your conscious mind. That damned amygdala which is a little almond-shaped structure that lies deeply embedded in the cerebrum, is one of the most powerful parts of your brain. It controls your behavior, even though you're not conscious of it. How does it work? When something upsets us, and that something could be a sound, a sight, or just a gut feeling, the amygdala sends notice to our bodies to prepare to fight or flee. The heartbeat speeds up, the blood pressure rises, and breathing quickens. During an argument, you'll often notice a physical response similar to how you react to fear, for instance, rapid heartbeats and tensing muscles. Recognizing that, your conscious mind, which resides in the prefrontal cortex, can refuse to obey its instructions. Typically, these amygdala hijackings come on fast and dissipate quickly, except in rare cases such as when a person develops post-traumatic stress disorder from a particularly horrible event or series of events. Knowing how these hijackings work, you know that if you allow yourself to react spontaneously, you will be prone to overreact. You can also comfort yourself with the knowledge that whatever psychological pain you are experiencing will go away before very long. C. Reconcile your feelings and your thinking. For most people, life is a never-ending battle between these two parts of the brain. While the amygdala's reactions come in spurts and then subside, reactions from the prefrontal cortex are more gradual and constant. The biggest difference between people who guide their own personal evolution and achieve their goals and those who don't is that those who make progress reflect on what causes their amygdala hijackings. D. Choose your habits well. Habit is probably the most powerful tool in your brain's toolbox. It is driven by a golf ball-sized lump of tissue called the basal ganglia at the base of the cerebrum. It is so deep-seated and instinctual that we are not conscious of it, though it controls our actions. If you do just about anything frequently enough over time, you will form a habit that will control you. Good habits are those that get you to do what your upper-level you wants, and bad habits are those that are controlled by your lower-level you and stand in the way of your getting what your upper-level you wants. You can create a better set of habits if you understand how this part of your brain works. For example, you can develop a habit that will make you need to work out at the gym. Developing this skill takes some work. The first step is recognizing how habits develop in the first place. Habit is essentially inertia, the strong tendency to keep doing what you have been doing or not doing what you have not been doing. Research suggests that if you stick with a behavior for approximately 18 months, you will build a strong tendency to stick to it nearly forever. For a long time, I didn't appreciate the extent to which habits control people's behavior. I experienced this at Bridgewater in the form of people who agreed with our work principles in the abstract, but had trouble living by them. I also observed it with friends and family members who wanted to achieve something but constantly found themselves working against their own best interests. Then I read Charles Duhigg's best-selling book, The Power of Habit, which really opened my eyes. I recommend that you read it yourself if your interest in this subject goes deeper than what I'm able to cover here. Duhigg's core idea is the role of the three-step habit loop. The first step is a cue, some trigger that tells your brain to go into automatic mode and which habit to use, according to Duhigg. Step two is the routine, which can be physical or mental or emotional. Finally, there is a reward which helps your brain figure out if this particular loop is worth remembering for the future. Repetition reinforces this loop until over time it becomes automatic. This anticipation and craving is the key to what animal trainers call operant conditioning, which is a method of training that uses positive reinforcement. For example, dog trainers use a sound, typically a clicker, to reinforce behavior by pairing that sound with a more desirable reward, typically food, until the dog will perform the desired behavior when it merely hears the click. In humans, Duhigg says, rewards can be just about anything, ranging from food or drugs that cause physical sensations to emotional payoffs such as the feelings of pride that accompany praise or self-congratulation. Habits put your brain on automatic pilot. In neuroscientific terms, the basal ganglia takes over from your cortex so that you can execute activities without even thinking about them. Reading Duhigg's book taught me that if you really want to change, the best thing you can do is choose which habits to acquire and which to get rid of, and then go about doing that. To help you, I recommend that you write down your 3 most harmful habits. Do that right now. Now, pick one of those habits and be committed to breaking it. Can you do that? That would be extraordinarily impactful. If you break all 3, you will radically improve the trajectory of your life. Or you can pick habits that you want to acquire and then acquire them. The most valuable habit I've acquired is using pain to trigger quality reflections. If you can acquire this habit yourself, you will learn what causes your pain and what you can do about it, and it will have an enormous impact on your effectiveness. E. Train your lower level you with kindness and persistence to build the right habits. I used to think that the upper level you needed to fight with the lower level you to gain control, but over time, I've learned that it is more effective to train that subconscious emotional you the same way you would teach a child to behave the way you would like him or her to behave, with loving kindness and persistence, so that the right habits are acquired. F. Understand the differences between right-brained and left-brained thinking. Just as your brain has its conscious upper part and its subconscious lower part, it also has 2 halves called hemispheres. You might have heard it said that some people are more left-brained while others are more right-brained. That's not just a saying. Caltech professor Roger Sperry won the Nobel Prize in Medicine for discovering it. In a nutshell, 1. The left hemisphere reasons sequentially, analyzes details, and excels at linear analysis. Left-brained or linear thinkers who are analytically strong are often called bright. 2. The right hemisphere thinks across categories, recognizes themes, and synthesizes the big picture. Right-brained or lateral thinkers with more street smarts are often called smart. Most people tend to get more of their instructions from one side than the other, and they have trouble understanding people who get theirs from the opposite side. Our experience has been that left-brained folks tend to see right-brained folks as spacey or abstract, while right-brained thinkers tend to find left-brained thinkers literal or narrow. I have seen wonderful results occur when people know where their own and others' inclinations lie, realize that both ways of thinking are invaluable, and assign responsibilities accordingly. G. Understand how much the brain can and cannot change. This brings us to an important question. Can we change? We can all learn new facts and skills, but can we also learn to change how we are inclined to think? The answer is a qualified yes. Brain plasticity is what allows your brain to change its soft wiring. For a long time, scientists believed that after a certain critical period in childhood, most of our brain's neurological connections were fixed and highly unlikely to change. But recent research has suggested that a wide variety of practices, from physical exercise to studying to meditation, can lead to physical and physiological changes in our brains that affect our abilities to think and form memories. In a study of Buddhist monks who had practiced more than 10,000 hours of meditation, researchers at the University of Wisconsin measured significantly higher levels of gamma waves in their brains. These waves are associated with perception and problem solving. That doesn't mean the brain is infinitely flexible. If you have a preference for a certain way of thinking, you might be able to train yourself to operate another way and find that easier to do over time. But you're very unlikely to change your underlying preference. Likewise, you may be able to train yourself to be more creative, but if you're not naturally creative, there's likely a limit to what you can do. That is simply reality, so we all might as well accept it and learn how to deal with it. There are coping techniques that we can use. For example, the creative, disorganized person who is likely to lose track of time can develop the habit of using alarms. The person who isn't good at some type of thinking can train himself to rely on the thinking of others who are better at it. The best way to change is through doing mental exercises. As with physical exercise, this can be painful unless you enlist the habit loop discussed earlier to connect the rewards to the actions, rewiring your brain to love learning and beneficial change. Remember that accepting your weaknesses is contrary to the instincts of those parts of your brain that want to hold on to the illusion that you are perfect. Doing the things that will reduce your instinctual defensiveness takes practice and requires operating in an environment that reinforces open-mindedness. As you'll see when we get into work principles, I've developed a number of tools and techniques that help overcome that resistance individually and across organizations. Instead of expecting yourself or others to change, I found that it's often most effective to acknowledge one's weaknesses and create explicit guardrails against them. This is typically a faster and higher probability path to success.